Well, I'm glad all three of us are actually here. Duncan, bring me up to date. Edited highlights. You're physically now in Bristol, are you?
Yes. Yes, exactly. And I'll pop down to Brighton this afternoon. We can see each other for what's been almost 2 years.
Good heavens, yes.
I know, yeah. Funny enough, Riva was almost going to also be able to join, but she got her green card today and flew back instead.
Oh, well, bless her.
I know, yeah. I think she's lost her passport 3 times in the last year. It's a record, really. things are good. Some context, I guess, that was probably already shared over a message. But yeah, Barrett and I met in Austin at the Urbit Assembly Conference that multiple of our friends were kind of doing various things. Actually, Reba couldn't make it because of her green card. Jonathan Blow replaced her talk there. But actually, he did a really good job, too, and I think kind of closed it out on a good note. But throughout that time, Barrett and I were talking and your name came up in terms of philosophical influences from myself. And he was very curious to have some more time to be able to kind of probe at your ideas. So thought it would make sense for all of us to just kind of be on one call.
This is awesome. And how formal is this? Is this a podcast? Is this a...
Yeah. It's a podcast. So, but it can be as formal or as informal. It's just sort of like a organic spur of the moment, you know, just trying to bring things together and throwing out some ideas. I don't even really do introductions. It usually just starts with like some random assemblage of music and then just goes straight into a conversation, kind of.
That's absolutely cool. And who are your normal listeners? Would you just?
I don't know, Duncan. How would you describe them? They're like Gen Z.
Yeah, there's kind of a continuation of like. It is hard to describe. It's probably a younger audience than most of the stuff that you've put online already, David. I would say it's more kind of like art world outcast adjacent kind of people across kind of all domains, whether it's like, yeah, literary or music or I think that's one kind of like key thing through a lot of I think the contain and adjacent kind of podcast extended universe, just kind of like, yeah, some formal training of some kind, whether it's like music or art or something other, and then kind of making a space outside of that space for being able to have some income.
David Pierce, just to give some context, and Duncan just spoke about how we met. So David, you are a transhumanist philosopher and the founder of the Transhumanist Association, one of the co-founders. And I'm just wondering, for a little bit of background, what is transhumanism in a sort of like summarization to you?
Hello, Barrett. I like to summarize transhumanism in terms of the three supers: super intelligence, super longevity, and super happiness. Super intelligence is the idea that rather than being the culmination of evolution, humans are a stepping stone to something radically more sophisticated. Many possible different conceptions of post-human superintelligence, ranging for entirely machine-based superintelligence to the scenario that I personally favor. This is the idea that post-human superintelligence will also be our biological descendants, massively genetically rewritten, augmented by machine intelligence, but nonetheless human. So much more could be said there, but that's the first super intelligence. Second super longevity. This is the idea that just as silicon robots can be repaired and upgraded indefinitely, there is no immutable law of nature that says that biological robots must crumble away and die. And transhumanists hope to defeat the biology of aging. Realistically, older people today might do well to sign up for cryonics and even cryothanasia. Otherwise, they're not going to make it. But yeah, so that's the second super longevity. The third super happiness, my particular focus, this is the idea that it's going to be possible to replace our Darwinian biology of pain and misery and suffering that has been so adaptive over hundreds of millions of years with a new architecture of mind, life based entirely on information-sensitive gradients of well-being. And not merely is it going to be possible to use biotechnology, genetic engineering to reprogram the biosphere and get rid of suffering, it's also going to be possible to engineer life based ultimately, probably on gradients of superhuman bliss. I don't personally consider this as morally urgent in the way that the problem of suffering is morally urgent. But as we gain mastery over our reward circuitry, there is nothing impossible to stop us creating a life that is orders of magnitude richer and more blissful than anything physiologically feasible today.
That's very interesting. The concept of superhuman bliss, I think in the hedonistic imperative, you talk a lot about this sort of like state of bliss or like nirvana. It almost has, to me, I think it's really interesting because, you know, generally when we talk about stuff like bliss or transcending like a pleasure pain axis or matrix, usually those two things, like Jacques Lacan would call this like jouissance or something like that. You know, you sort of merge those two things together to sort of like transcend the pleasure pain matrix. How would you go about through like CRISPR genome editing, you know, trying to like, you said it's like raising hedonic levels, correct? In the mind or?
Yes. Each of us has an approximate hedonic range and an approximate hedonic set point of our hedonic treadmill. And if very, very conventionally you imagine our normal hedonic range is, let's say, minus 10 for anguish and despair, zero for emotionally neutral experience, and plus 10 for sublime ecstasy, what I think we want to do is recalibrate the hedonic treadmill initially, so that everyone can enjoy the high hedonic set point of some of today's extreme outliers. The recalibration is important because there's a critical distinction between being blissful and blissed out. Now, personally, I would have no objection to being blissed out all the time, but nonetheless, this is not consistent with retaining critical insight, social responsibility, intellectual progress. There would be intense selection pressure against any predisposition for us all to become wireheads. And so, yeah, from a distinctively transhumanist perspective, the idea is, yeah, essentially ratcheting up hedonic range and hedonic set points. While critically, and I know it's a mouthful, information sensitive gradients of well-being. Imagine waking up tomorrow morning in a fantastically good mood, willing and able to pursue all the activities that you most enjoy. It's not a case of my or any other transhumanist trying to impose our values on you. Just think of it as a recalibration of your hedonic set point. In terms of the actual tools to do this, A combination of a CRISPR genome editing, pre-implantation, genetic screening and counseling for all prospective parents. But over the next decade or two, it's going to be possible to use genome editing to help existing human and non-human animals. Already we've seen very recently, only a few months ago, the use of CRISPR genome editing to tweak the genomes of existing humans with a very nasty disorder, transthyretin amyloidosis. But in principle, there is nothing to stop your genome being tweaked. Let's say here's just an example. Imagine if you want the nice versions of the far and far out genes that Joe Cameron has. Joe Cameron is this woman. She was in the news a little while ago. Never gets anxious, depressed, extraordinarily high pain threshold. A real hedonic outlier. You too, in principle, could have her versions of far and far out genes, which cause elevated levels of anandamide from the Sanskrit to bliss. I could say a lot more here, but yeah, horrendously complicated, all sorts of pitfalls. But nonetheless, as a civilization, I think we need to have a serious debate about how much suffering we want in the world and how best to get rid of it, because we're living in the last century of involuntary suffering.
I have a few points that I've thought out, and it's just a couple of things. So just in terms of like creating meaning and, you know, stuff like art, you know, there's a lot of notions that art is created and sort of bound to this idea of suffering. And I'm sort of the opinion that we don't actually really live in a society anymore that's sort of like a misnomer or a trope, because we don't have any sort of way to like reify the cultural objects through this understanding of suffering. Because I think actually on the contrary, we're sort of like a group as humans that's sort of like addicted to the violence of positivity and positive reinforcement as something that's like an ideal. We see it all the time with like social media and likes and this sort of like dopamine, serotonin that we're always like consistently trying to produce over and over, because we don't actually, because that's something that we seek and it's like sort of like this palliative measure. I don't know. You were actually mentioned in Byung Chul Han's last book, which is actually a book all about suffering called The Palliative Society, which I think it's a great book. I don't know if you know that.
I blush to say I haven't read it, so apologies, but I will add it to my do list.
So basically what I'm wondering is, how do we go about and find our values if we don't have any sort of suffering? Because, you know, Rene Girard talks a lot about like the need of like the out group or the outcast or the sort of like scapegoat as sort of like this fundamentally organizing function of all sort of like social orders and cohesions. It almost seems to me, not to go on a little bit too much on this, but it almost seems to me that like we don't really have cultural objects. We only have these sort of like quasi transcendental rhetorical back and forths that are sort of like creating difference and creating our sort of existences or beings or designs. So what I'm wondering is, if we're all in this like blissed out state 24/7, is it almost like a panpsychist thing? Like, is it almost like a religious stupor? Like, what would that look like in the absence of society?
I mean, I think the information sensitivity point is really kind of where we're going to have to hammer in here, because like, yeah, I don't think that this would prevent in-groups and out-groups. I just think that it would feel a lot better to be in the out-group than it does right now, to be like a little glib. Like, you could still be bullied. You're just not like, you know, I think that like information,
It's kind of like the picture of like the death by a thousand cuts, you know, where they have this like ecstatic smile on their face.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, for lack of a better picture, I mean, I think that is kind of like, at least how I imagine this, that there is still like, you know, parts of society that are engaging in a lot of the same like social games that we want to engage in right now. There will be popular and less popular people, but everyone's just going to have a way higher floor of what their worst day ever was.
Yes, this is it. For evolutionary reasons, we are social primates, and humans have billions upon billions of frequently conflicting, logically conflicting preferences, and there is simply no way, logically no way, that anyone, not even post-human superintelligence, could reconcile all these conflicting preferences. But what one can do is pursue hedonic uplift and ensure everyone has an extremely high default quality of life. I mean, I could certainly talk to you about my kind of vision of the good society, but the more specifics one goes into, the less likely they are to be realized. So as not to lose some of your earlier points, the question of meaning. Sometimes you'll get someone like Jordan Peterson or someone contrasting happiness with meaning. But other things being equal, the happier you are, the higher your hedonic set points, the more meaningful and significant and purposeful your life will feel. Conversely, sadly, people who are depressive, certainly people who are chronically depressive, their lives feel empty, drained of meaning. Some may have nihilistic thoughts. By its very nature, a civilization based on gradients of intelligent bliss will be experienced as hyper-meaningful, more meaningful than anything physiologically possible today. So it would be a mistake to contrast happiness and meaning. Your point about art, this criticism that a society in which we were all temperamentally extremely happy would be a society of Philistines, it's possible in one sense, but nonetheless, for a start, it's going to be possible to use molecular neuroscience, neuroscanning to identify the molecular signature of aesthetic experience, good and bad, of beauty, and massively amplify and enrich the substrates of beauty. And just as medieval mystics could sort of see the world see the world in a grain of sand, it will be possible, optionally, and I'm stressing this is not a prediction, but optionally it will be possible to find everyday life transcendently beautiful if one is actually prepared to tackle the molecular signature of beauty and aesthetic experience. So rather than inaugurating a cultural wasteland, it's quite possible that the era of aesthetic beauty has scarcely begun. Sorry, Duncan, you're going to say.
No, totally. I just wanted to add on to that point. I feel like Andreas, like my little mental model of Andreas here is also screaming about, like, you know, if you radically raise the kind of lowest experience that somebody can have, you can also explore the state space of experiences with so much more confidence. So, like, I think people, like, you know, if you remove bad trips or the, you know, the really like lowest points of, you know, poking around in the outskirts of psychedelia, you know, you could imagine our creativity could only, you know, really expand, or kind of the state space of possible experiences only really expand when we kind of have this like bolstering of like, how bad can those, you know, explorations get?
Yes, very much so. I mean, though I describe transhumanism in terms of the three supers, some would add another super, psychedelic transhumanism, or you could argue this is incorporated within full spectrum superintelligence, that once one makes experience below hedonic zero physically, physiologically impossible, it'll be feasible safely to explore radically alien state spaces of consciousness. And in spite of the excitement in the media at the moment about the therapeutic potential of psychedelics, I'm personally very skeptical here. I think our dark Darwinian minds are simply unsuited for psychedelics as they exist today. But once we do get rid of the physical substrates of unpleasant experience, then, yeah, billions of state spaces of consciousness is different from waking and dreaming can be explored. The nature of aesthetic experience in radically altered state spaces, it is literally inconceivable to us. We don't have the vocabulary or the conceptual scheme. Yeah.
That's actually very interesting. One thing that I'm really sort of wondering is what are the sort of like limits of hedonic bliss? Because I actually, talking with a friend, there's actually the Simone Weil quote, "That which limits is God. God is the measure of all things. It is God who prevents the sea from encroaching further than it should. We must do like him in the case of our own interior sea. We have got to become perfect obedience because we are not God." And one of the things that I sort of am thinking about right now is if we're already in the state of hedonic bliss, then we don't really need to like culture, art, or like anything like that, because we're already sort of in this state. Would you say that the state is what creates its own sort of meaning? Is the state like an absolute limit in that sense?
One can imagine if today's hedonic range is minus 10 to 0 to plus 10, one can imagine a civilization with a greater hedonic range, let's say plus 70 to a plus 100. And people in that civilization may be hyper motivated to access the higher reaches. We simply don't know. It's this idea of the default setting, that the darkest depths of post-human life can in principle be richer than human peak experiences.
One thing I'm wondering though is, with a lot of this stuff, like the state is already kind of, and I know you're sort of like loosely associated with the effective altruism movement. And one of the criticisms I think that comes up a lot is this idea that there's this sort of like structural state power that's already kind of animating these technologies, and these technologies are sort of like in this epistemological mishmash between the state power and what its aims are, and then how these things become applied. Because, it's like, in many ways, it's like if we take the whole Promethean project and we sort of abstract it from these structures that already lie, we can say, oh yeah, this is like a great idea. But unfortunately, so much of this stuff is just tied to these systems that are not optimized for, because capital runs on this kind of like excess of suffering, so there's a sort of like, and you find it in like the digital spaces as well, Instagram and all of these other things. Like there's almost like this manipulation and addiction that sort of permeates and encapsulates through this stuff. So that's just one thing that comes to my mind.
No, exactly. I mean, I think the elephant in the room here is kind of like, who pays for this stuff? And that's, that is a very big question. We could spend a lot of time kind of ideating on that. But I think to your second point about like, is the suffering necessary for the attention economy to happen? I don't think so at all. And I think actually, like, not to fetishize any of the companies that we're kind of discussing there, but I do think that a lot of that is just kind of like the lowest hanging fruit and the easiest way that it has been able to get people addicted to stuff and use it and kind of like, have outrage kind of be this mechanism by which attention can kind of be garnered more and more. But nothing in principle. I mean, maybe there is some law of physics, quote unquote, about human psychology, that it's like easier to create outrage than it is bliss. But I think that I don't know if you've ever gone really deep on TikTok to the point where it's told you to go to bed, but there are platforms that are like starting to try and like, I think, have users end with a little bit more of a, positive experience and not necessarily like hating the platform. I think TikTok has other issues that we could definitely get into, but I think that I think that these systems are going to have to start adapting to not be phased out there. But who pays for the, you know, CRISPR gene editing and the kind of top down higher level design? I think that's a much different question.
But I don't think these systems are necessarily optimized for, you know, sort of like user happiness themselves. It's almost kind of like we're sort of in this state in many ways, like we're already kind of in this transhumanist state, because so much of like what constitutes like our temporalities and our, you know, who we are is based on language and rhetorical values, inscribing characteristics of whatever it is, like language or text. Like they really do tell us who we are, and they're telling us, they're feeding us these very sort of like, I almost want to say like futuristic narratives around being and subjectivity that are actually making us different. You know, like language is sort of like a quasi transcendental property in its own right. So I'm almost, on one hand, you know, human is not this like, you know, stationary thing to begin with, but the transhumanist project is almost like there's no like happiness involved in that, you know, just because we're sort of engaging with this, you know, really weird time where it's like TikTok is telling us to go to bed, and all of these systems are constantly reinforcing and confirming who we are for us. Where does like the incentive to make people happy? Because like you said, it's like who pays for it? Does that even matter? I guess maybe I have like a bit more of like a fatalistic view on that.
Once again, you raise a lot of issues there. I mean, let's perhaps explore the different strands of the abolitionist project and consider how much they will cost. I think perhaps our biggest priority at the moment, though plenty of people would disagree with me, I think our biggest priority is to get factory farms shut and outlawed, that animal agriculture is the largest and worst source of severe and readily avoidable suffering in the world today. And realistically, the way that this is going to happen in the quickest possible time is via cultured meat and animal products. And there needs to be resources plowed into accelerating the development, commercialization of cultured meat and animal products, legislation enacted, let's say, that closes slaughterhouses in the year 2030. Of course, I think they should be outlawed today. But if you enact legislation like that, it gives a tremendous commercial incentive to develop, commercialize cultured meat, animal products. I mean, that is expensive, but not ridiculously expensive. Other strands of the project, take, as I said, if we're going to radically elevate hedonic range, hedonic set points, get rid of the horrors of depression, pain disorders, we're going to need to offer access to all prospective parents, pre-implantation genetic screening and counseling, and soon genome editing. And this is, of course, incredibly thorny issue. The specter of eugenics will be raised. But, I mean, just take something like SCN9A, the so-called volume knob for pain. If some kind of consensus existed, it would be possible for prospective parents to be able to choose benign versions of SCN9A for their future kids, ensuring everyone born into the world has a high pain threshold and pain tolerance, i.e. not complete absence of pain. This for now would be extremely premature. But today's outliers, people who describe pain as just a useful signaling mechanism, no one should be born into the world with a predisposition to suffer intense physical pain. There is no master volume for happiness in the same way that there is for pain tolerance. But nonetheless, if as a society we're prepared to have a debate about these issues, it will be cost-effective to use pre-implantation genetic speeding, counseling, CRISPR genome editing to create happier, healthier kids. And it's tremendously cost-effective, not least, though I hate reducing depression to economic costs. Hundreds of millions of people in the world today are clinically or subclinically depressed. This is a tremendous burden on the economy. If we live in a world in which no one is depressed, essentially economic growth will surge. And in terms of the cost too, essentially any technology that can be digitized, any information technology, the price trends inexorably to zero. So though one shouldn't dismiss cost altogether, when it comes to pre-implantation genetic screening and counseling, it would be tremendously cost-effective. If one thinks of the burden of some of the better-known genetic diseases, if one could prevent them, very, very cost-effective. What would be, at least at today's prices, be extremely expensive is going on to take the abolitionist project to the rest of the living world. I mean, the notion of some kind of pan-species welfare state, not merely does it sound ecologically illiterate, it probably sounds ridiculously expensive too. But this is to underplay the power of modern technology, genome editing, synthetic gene drives, the possibility of using tunable gene drives to remotely control levels of non-human animal population. Entire species can be remotely managed. Essentially, we're heading on a dark dystopian Orwellian scenario would be a kind of surveillance state, a global phenomenon. But on another possible scenario is a world in which all sentient beings can be can flourish without being at risk of being predated or starving. We're not going to run out of computer power. Every cubic meter of the planet is going to be computationally accessible to micromanagement and control. We're going to need to, as intelligent moral agents, we're going to need to decide how much suffering we want to exist in the living world.
I think about, because you talk about, you know, how it's going to be implemented, is that there's already this sort of like idea, and it's not really an idea, that, you know, the sort of elites of the world already embarking on this kind of like biohacking. They're already undertaking these sort of like biohacking experiments, but they're only allowing them to be used for themselves, right? Like, I think one of the issues is that because we're sort of at this point where we're sort of at the crux of where labor becomes automated, that we don't actually need bodies to produce for the kinds of people who would potentially be funding or, you know, engaging in these kind of experiments towards hedonistic bliss. I think that this may be something, and one of the things that I'm worried about is that this may be something that only like a certain group can actually access, only because the idea of democratizing it, like we're almost at this point right now where the rest of the world, the reason why we have like populist movements that are rising up, also being squashed on a regular basis, is we have this issue of biopolitics, lockdowns through the reinforcement of, and I think eventually it will go to climate lockdowns. They clearly are probably not even thinking that they're elites. They're just completely sort of unconscious of the desires for like happiness and meaning. And how do you reconcile the fact that the people who are sort of like the faces of these technological, you know, they're not really optimizing it to be shared or like distributed amongst, you know, regular, shitty, normal people?
In spite of the fact that all my political instincts left liberal, I think it would be a mistake to demonize the elites, global elites. And someone like Bill Gates, for example, that the staple of many conspiracy theories. What was the Bill and Miranda Gates Foundation? I know there have been changes there, have done a lot of good work, and billionaires are intensely competitive for the most part. It's essentially, you get these charitable foundations, you get the sort of the Forbes list of the biggest charitable givers. There is a ruthless competitiveness when it comes to male altruism too.
But that's all tax write-off stuff and private equity liquidation. I mean, you know, like, so it's, on one hand, yeah, it might be egotistical, like there might be some competition towards altruism or portraying altruism, but I feel like a lot of that is just sort of symbolic because, I mean, you could look around, we're in this sort of like profoundly unequal time where people, there's a sort of resentment that is building up, regardless of like who gives to what charity. We're sort of at this moment, we're at the time of the last man. You start to see these like people like Bill Gates, and they equate it with like, you know, get in the pod, eat your bugs kind of thing. Like, we're going to tell you what to do. And people are still trying to assert this 20th century subjectivity. And I feel like there's a kind of expanse, and there's almost like this need that people have to assert this thing, right?
Well, take Bill Gates. I mean, Bill Gates has funded cultured meat products. As I said, it's as I said, my gut instincts are left liberal. I favor, you know, kind of universal basic income, guaranteed access to healthcare, accommodation, Scandinavian style models. But nonetheless, the world's richest people, they are not, in terms of their motivation, radically different from you or me. Bill Gates actually wants to make the world a better place. I mean, it's okay. He is ferociously competitive, has been at Microsoft. He is quite high on the spectrum, but nonetheless, he is not evil. It is simplistic to demonize elites like that. Yes. It's. Yeah, well, yeah.
No.
I focus on the biological genetic because it's neglected. We could have, a discussion on political, economic, social reform. We're going to need a twin track policy. But I don't consider that probably that, for example, class war is a fruitful way to bring about the biohappiness revolution. Yeah.
But the one thing that I have is that within sort of like the natural sciences, you have construals and criteria that actually set the sort of like research that you potentially want to, you know, activate or go forward with. And I'm just sort of like, I guess more a bit of like somebody who sees things in terms of like, what are the structures that, because obviously it's like, yes, you know, Bill Gates or whoever these people are, like, I think evil is, let's just say there's not this like activated motivation to potentially murder millions of people. Like, I don't consider, you know, the quote unquote elites necessarily in that way. But one of the things that I'm like wondering about is you kind of, so with longevity, super longevity. So if you want to actually, Byung-Chul Han in the last, you're actually in the last paragraph of his book. And he talks about a pain-free life of permanent happiness is not a human life. Life which tracks down and drives out its own negativity cancels itself out. Death and pain belong together. In pain, death is anticipated. If you seek to remove all pain, you will also have to abolish death. But life without death and pain is not human life. It is undead life. And so basically, in order to survive, humans are abolishing themselves, which in my almost case of thinking is that if we're sort of in this pathway to sort of universal bliss, what's the difference between us all just killing ourselves, like, or committing suicide or reconciling with, you know, extinction or mass extinction?
I mean, I think that kind of pain justification is a huge cope. I think that evolution has recruited so many mechanisms to correlate our meaning with the kind of like spectrum and comparison arguments of like, oh, if you don't feel the other side of this emotion, how can these things be real? But I mean, just ask a serious depressive who's been in a period, I mean, I'm sure we all have, where it's like, very hard to remember the feeling of happiness.
We're always in a state of forgetting. I think that's sort of like our biggest problem is we always forget. We're in permanent forgetting. I think that's the kind of precondition that sets forth a lot of this stuff, is that we've forgotten everything.
Too many people suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder for this to be universally true, I think. Just to come back to this idea, if one is essentially a secular Buddhist, if one thinks overriding obligation is to minimize, mitigate suffering, there are technically feasible and sociologically feasible scenarios. And the idea of either kind of strong antinatalism or destroying the world, these are not sociologically feasible ways to get rid of suffering. So, yeah, we need a secular Buddhists need to have an alliance with the fanatical life lovers. It's not fruitful exploring scenarios that involve the extinction of life, I don't think. Yeah.
So you're a fanatical life lover. So you're not an antinatalist.
Oh no, I think Darwinian life on Earth is monstrous. The thrust of our discussion today has been on bliss and happiness and joy, but I think that Darwinian life is inconceivably evil. But despite this incredibly bleak diagnosis, I don't think it is fruitful to explore scenarios involving the, for example, destruction of life or humanity, anything like that. I think that is a dead end, that one needs to work with the life lovers to, phase out Darwinian life in its existing guise and replace it by something better, something inconceivably sublime. So, in one sense, this is the end of humanity, but not in some kind of apocalyptic extinction of event, but rather we are going to edit our own genetic source code and claw our way out of the Darwinian abyss.
I think, if we look at the 20th century, which had sort of, ramped up Prometheanism and sort of, it almost like came the century of the last man in a sense. And it sort of sought to overcome the human or overcome the man and become something else. It caused a lot more suffering than any other century in human history. I think the 20th century, more people died on the path to this like naturalization of heaven than in any other century by far. I mean, that's basically like the crux of, there's always this need to naturalize heaven, but I think that's kind of like a cope, in many ways. I see the biological angle though. Like I see that if you raise these hedonic points in your brain, that you can experience these things. Like the only thing I'm wondering is who or why would anybody sort of like implement this? Like, what's to stop anybody from not doing this or it not going totally awry based on what we already sort of like know? I know Bruno Latour. Do you know him?
Yes.
Yeah, Bruno Latour, he kind of talks a little bit about the 20th century and the mistakes that have been made by seeking this kind of to aspire to.
One should be mindful of the countless potential ways in which life can go wrong. But this is the very nature of bringing new life into the world. All kids born into the world today unique, untested genetic experiments. And what essentially I'm urging is that we start to load the genetic dice. I think it's worth upholding, enshrining in the law the principle of the sanctity of life, even though I don't literally believe life is sacred. Humans simply cannot be trusted.
But if life is not inherently sacred, then how would you say that Darwinianism is inherently evil? Like, how can you make that kind of justification? That's all I'm sort of...
But by Darwinian life, I simply mean that it has been tremendously fitness-enhancing to undergo all forms of pain, discontent, suffering, jealousy, envy, nasty emotions, that they helped our genes leave more copies of themselves than the ancestral environment. And fortunately, the nature of selection pressure is poised to change, in that over the next few centuries, there is likely to be a reproductive evolution that, starting off with well-known genetic diseases, but in the longer run, morphing into genes, modulating everything from hedonic tone, hedonic set points, pain tolerance, one has to say it, yes, intelligence. Essentially, prospective parents are likely to be choosing the genetic makeup of their offspring in anticipation of the likely behavioral and psychological effects of their choices. So the very nature of selection pressure is going to change. How the reproductive revolution will play out in the long term, clearly I don't know. But nonetheless, just imagine you are a prospective parent. You can choose the approximate hedonic range, hedonic set points, pain tolerance of your future offspring. Most parents are sincere when they say they want to have happy children. They're more fun to raise. So in the long run, there is going to be strong selection pressure against some of our nastier genes and allelic combinations. What I would like to see, which is not going to happen, sadly, is some kind of 100-year plan under the auspices of the World Health Organization, with its fabulously ambitious definition of health, complete physical, social, emotional well-being. But I would like to see a 100-year plan to defeat the biology and genetics of suffering. More realistically, hundreds, maybe more pessimistically, even thousands of years of genetic change lie ahead. But we're no longer at the mercy of blind natural selection. That's the evolution has traditionally evolution has no foresight. Mutations are random with respect to the direction of evolution. Essentially, Darwinian life is this monstrous engine for the creation of suffering. But if we are prepared to rewrite our own source code, then life can be sublime by its very nature.
What about the pain of love?
Today, romantic love is bound up with pain almost as much with pleasure. It has considerable affinities with obsessive-compulsive disorder. Countless people right now are lovelorn, suffering from unrequited love. It is a form of toxic psychosis in many cases. However, love doesn't have to be like that. I mean, one can, here's an example, one can glimpse what love could be like if one studies people on MDMA or ecstasy, as it's better known. When people are loved up on MDMA, they love themselves, and just as importantly, they love everyone else. But the kind of love expressed isn't a jealous, possessive ownership. Essentially, on MDMA, people want to give everyone a hug, this sense of I love the world and the world loves me. Now, in the ancestral environment, such states of universal love and bliss and loving everyone, essentially, they would be profoundly maladaptive. But the option is going to exist to create love that isn't exclusive in the way that monogamous pair bonding is today. MDMA releases not just a lot of serotonin and dopamine, but also oxytocin, the so-called trust hormone. And whether via sophisticated designer drugs or looking decades into the future, genome tweaking, it will be possible, at least in principle, to have a society in which we don't feel the kind of quasi-sociopathic indifference to each other that we do in everyday waking consciousness today. I stress this is simply one scenario. I might find a society of MDMA-like consciousness an appealing prospect. Not everyone would do so, but it's certainly going to be an option.
I'm sort of thinking about this love thing, because to love is essentially to struggle beyond solitude with everything in the world that can just animate existence. And one of the things I think about, you know, in when it comes to something like love, is that with love you lose yourself, you dissolve the self into like a kind of holistic oneness with somebody else. And it's almost like you start to see your bliss through the eyes of another person. And I think with today's consumerism and, you know, technologically mediated relationships and this internalization of the master-slave dialectic that technology and the internet and, you know, everybody saying that like Web3 is going to be better than Web2. I mean, that's just complete horseshit in my opinion. I'm a little bit more skeptical of technology as being something, given the kind of internalization of pain and dicks that we've actually experienced now, because not to go back to Bruno Latour, he sort of claims that modern society never really existed. You had sort of like a modern society, postmodern society. As somebody who, so this is kind of weird shit, but I'm just almost like wondering, how is it that we, Duncan, can you help me out here? Sorry about this.
Yeah. I think so to a degree. I mean, I think the, yeah, the technology aspect of it is a little bit harder. And I think that the incentive structures around that will probably like, yeah, it will. I mean, I think in general, the argument that David was making about like potentially just selfish desires from prospective parents is like one lens that I've understood kind of how all of this will happen, regardless of like any individual or state body or kind of like collective thing. I think that does go back to, you know, inherent class divides that will initially cause. And I think that there will be, you know, patterns of these kind of things rolling out.
Involuntary childlessness, unfortunately, causes a great deal of suffering. For evolutionary reasons, most people want to have kids, which is why the strong antinatalist argument, that the way to get rid of suffering is simply not to have kids, simply doesn't work. There would be tremendous selection pressure against any predisposition not to go forth and multiply.
And I'm about to, you know, potentially offend, I doubt any of these people will hear this, but I think another case in point of that is like how many justifications you see in the effective altruism movement for having a kid. Even though the most obvious thing is to not have a kid and do a lot more with your money and have like ideological children, if you're actually trying to like maximize your output, like the most popular opinions in that community are these, you know, long-winded justifications of like, you know, the benefits of having a kid, and those get like recruited around in a movement that's like trying to optimize for their efficiency. So I think like, yeah, I don't think we should undercut the desire that humans have to, you know, have children that do better than themselves.
I don't know. That all just seems like modernist abstractions to me. Like, I almost feel like, I don't know, like the whole crux of this like reason, effective altruism, wrong thing circle is a lot of it is just kind of a rhetorical thing, but in my opinion, it almost doesn't really add up. Can you explain like effective altruism?
Yeah, no.
Because I mean, it says it's the opposite of to egoism and you know, self-interest, but isn't it sort of like this, like what it's buttressed by is exactly that, is like a system that only seeks self-interest.
Duncan, or I'm very happy to launch into a spiel.
Yeah, go first, please.
No. The effective altruist movement is fairly new, even though many people before the term existed would in some sense aspire to be effective altruists. This, essentially, the idea is that instead of being gripped by emotional saliency, that one tries to use one's time, energy, money in the most cost-effective way possible to minimize suffering, to maximize well-being. However, the effective altruist movement is tremendously diverse. It's work. It's very much work in progress. It started off very much focused on tackling existing sources of human and non-human suffering, earning to give. It took a lurch towards worries about AI safety. This is the idea that, there is a risk from artificial intelligence that's going to be some kind of machine intelligence explosion that may be inimical to sentience. So some EAs have been working on AI safety. But most recently, and most, well, to my mind, disconcertingly, there has been a growth in effective altruism in so-called long-termism. Long-termism is the idea that first wave effective altruism was myopic, focused on the here and now rather than the long-term future. Long-termism, it's itself, most of the best-known long-termists, William McGaskill, Toby Ord, are classical utilitarians, but long-termism means something very different if one is a secular Buddhist negative utilitarian. And though in one sense I'm a long-termist, this is one reason to focus on the biological genetic basis of suffering, that if we get rid of its molecular genetic substrates, we can get rid of suffering forever. Most of the best known long-termists in the EA movement are classical utilitarians.
Huh. That's very interesting. I really like this thing called post-cringe. I'm really into it because to me, like, post-cringe is almost like it's almost like a way to transcend the pleasure-pain matrix. I think that's kind of like when you get so fried out and you're like so freaked out and you've got all of this stuff going on in your head. Like, I almost feel like there's like these transcendental states that we can just go and access regularly, and I think that they're tools that anybody can kind of use. Like, I have a good friend who practices Dzogchen Tibetan Buddhist meditation, and I've gotten into that stuff as well. And it's almost like this, it's just kind of funny to me. I'm really interested in how the secular Buddhism and transhumanism, how they see themselves as being compatible.
One reason for calling oneself a secular Buddhist is to essentially, locate one's values in a much older tradition. If one describes oneself as a believer in suffering-focused ethics, or particularly if one describes oneself as a negative utilitarian, this opens up a real can of worms. People will sometimes suggest that you're plotting to get rid of suffering by destroying the world or something like that. Calling oneself a secular Buddhist is just a nod to the primacy of ending suffering in Buddhist ethics. Most transhumanists are optimists. They are not secular Buddhists, let alone negative utilitarians. And I don't want to in any way claim that I am typical here. But one doesn't need to buy into any kind of utilitarianism to think it would be good to use biotechnology to get rid of suffering.
What does a transhumanist look like? Does it look like a cyborg person? I've just what is like the aesthetics of a transhumanist, or does it look more and like just you and me, like a human?
Transhumanism is committed to so-called morphological freedom, which currently is more likely to take the form of choosing your own avatar in virtual reality, in Meta, in Oculus, or what have you. In the longer run, mastery of the genome will allow us to choose our physical incarnations in basement reality, but that's going to be much longer and more drawn out.
And I mean, I think another very applied case of this, not to say that the aesthetics have to be mirrored, but kind of an example of people who are taking their morphology into their own account, is just the trans community. And I think that that's, it's a very early example of kind of people who are just like, these genetic boundaries are not where, you know, my identity sits here, and I need to look and feel a different way in order to be myself.
Right.
So,
I would personally hope that gender goes the way of horns and a tail. But before that happy day, yes, it will be good to transcend, kind of binary gender and, the traditional norms. But, it's going to be a very long, slow, drawn-out process.
That's actually really interesting. If you could go a little bit more on transhumanism and identity.
I don't think there's any such thing as the official transhumanist position on identity. Most people probably implicitly have a notion of enduring metaphysical egos. But if one has a more Buddhist or Parfitian conception of personal identity, that enduring identity over time is a myth. And so even though it's quite likely that we are going to phase out the biology of aging, which intuitively would entail some form of quasi-immortality, in practice, the degree of metamorphosis involved in becoming transhuman and eventually posthuman and leading indefinite lifespans free from aging, in what sense will one be the same person as one's ancestral namesake? And does it matter? I mean, after all, most of us, when we wake up in the morning, don't instantly enter into a crisis of identity. Am I the same person who fell asleep last night? After all, my neurons are no longer identically configured and so forth. There is this great turnover there. As I said, I personally regard enduring metaphysical egos as a myth, but they're a useful fiction. If one didn't sustain this useful fiction, then society, economics, finance, politics, you name it, would collapse.
And I think on the topic of personal identity, I think the best kind of trichotomy that I've heard to kind of explain these kind of breakdowns comes from Daniel Kolak's work, and it kind of, goes between closed identity, which is definitely like the default assumption of, you're an individual in your body that persists over time, to kind of empty individualism, which would be, I think the position due to the facts of the matter that David and I kind of both agree on, that we feel where it's like each individual time slice at whatever, femtosecond we divide physics is, an individual self. And that diachronic string across those time slices is more of a hallucination than anything. But then Daniel Kolak's position, which he kind of thinks like resolves all of that, is like open individualism, which is just there's one identity. And each kind of, instantiation of that is part of some larger multi-headed thing, which I can't be the best representative of, but that is kind of a third position here.
So in the meantime, what should we be doing right now?
tough question.
if we truly can't wait, like how is it that we can bring about or naturalize heaven now? Can we do that? I'm just wondering.
Duncan, or do you want me to launch off into my spiel?
No, I mean, I think there is kind of a sliding scale here of things more like the rhetorical devices of what you were saying of like post-cringe, or even, you know, more realistically, some kind of meditative practice or like, yeah, positional stance.
I really believe in that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is going to be an aspect of getting people motivated and group coordination for sure. But I don't think I think it's a band-aid at best. And I think realistically, yeah, like personally, I've found actually exploring around and trying out enough antidepressants and like configurations of my life and finding ones that like work well. Definitely no one size fits all there. David and I have certainly settled on very different like drug regimes and day-to-day practices, but I think both have found things that work decently well. But yeah, I mean, how do we go from that to the much larger movement? I mean, I think that's an open question. I'd be curious of David's answer.
Yeah, I think about the Tibetans because, you know, they tried to give the world the gift of Dzogchen, and they've been persecuted mercilessly. I'm sort of like worried that if you, you know, codify stuff too much, that you just, you know, even if you have like the best intentions, it will just be like used against you. So like, I'm really into this practice of like acting like a retarded person sometimes, post cringe, or like any of this other kind of like fun game stuff.
Like, yeah, I mean, that's the right? Other Byak Chung Hong, like, isn't that the reference to like the idiot, right? Like,
Yeah,
butchered his name. But yeah, I mean, I love that. And I think that there is something to that too, especially with all of the like confines of identity that we know in social media. But again, I think that's like, those are small stepping stones.
Yeah.
That's stop gaps. Yeah, exactly.
Well, no, I mean, I definitely don't I agree that, you know, identity isn't this stationary fact that has been given to us. I mean, I think everyone from like Heidegger to Deleuze would basically agree that we're definitely in this mediating process towards something else. Like, so call this like post-Anthropocene. I don't know if there's a better word for that. That's kind of like a chuggy word, right?
Anthropocentric
always bothers me because the fucking intellectuals come up with these like really weird words to describe phenomena that's never been described before. Like there's no like singular word for it. Sorry, that's like an off rant because it's like very late here and I'm like kind of out of it. But what were you saying, Duncan? Sorry.
No, I think that is, I mean, that documentary of the same name, Anthropocene, certainly does, you know, cover a lot of these like Promethean efforts and looking at like resculpting the, you know, planet under human, output. But I think a lot of the context that term is used in is almost always to kind of look more at like side effects versus directed goals. And I think that, yeah, I mean, that is where a lot of the critical discourse has been, of seeing all of these things as kind of just like, you know, byproducts of humans not paying attention to some other aspect of a complex system. So I think that this work does necessitate a level of detail and organization that probably will, you know, necessitate new forms of human coordination to really get there. But yeah, I'm not pessimistic based on that. I don't think that we have to just like only work on the rhetorical level just because like moving atoms around is hard. It is.
Moving around atoms is hard.
It's a lot easier to say a bunch of words.
Oh yeah, definitely. I'm really into saying a bunch of words. I think saying a bunch of words is how we also give ourselves this like transhumanist, quasi-transhuman quality or essence as well. Mm-hmm. Like I really believe in like the power of rhetoric. You know, I like Jacques Derrida a lot, so I really do think words and language is extremely powerful.
I think this is where David and I are a little more analytical.
Yeah, I'm not an analytical person at all.
Yeah.
In any way. Like that's kind of what I think is interesting about this. David, I want to know, how do we solve all the world's problems? Like, how are we going to do this, right?
Well, I think precision and rigor are going to be needed.
But how do you get precision and rigor if everyone's already blissed out?
Well, this is what I recall. I'm arguing against getting blissed out and in favor of being blissful. And it's going to be really important, for example, to study the very happiest, high-functioning, hypothymic people today, to investigate possible biases, the risk of an absence of depressive realism, and so forth. The tools of science, rationality, and in the sphere of philosophy, bioethics, rigor. I don't go down the Derrida route, I'm afraid.
That's really interesting. And how does veganism fit into this?
Well, essentially, veganism, essentially, how can we start helping sentient beings if we are systematically harming them in factory farms and slaughterhouses? That a pig, for example, is as sentient and demonstrably as sapient as a pre-linguistic toddler, and we are treating pigs and other non-human animals in ways that would get the perpetrator locked up for life if the victim were human. So, I would urge any of your listeners who aren't already vegan to quit meat and animal products. Realistically, as I was saying earlier, then we're going to need a cultured meat revolution because too many people are morally apathetic. But we need to become vegan or in vitrotarian ourselves, and in the longer run, veganize the rest of the biosphere, which is going to be technically possible. Once again, biotechnology is going to be transformative, and that whereas Darwinian life is essentially based on sentient beings hurting, harming, and killing each other, eating each other, the proverbial survivor of the fittest, we ought to be aiming for a pan-species welfare state.
What about overpopulation? Is that a concern?
Currently, most likely not. But if we do phase out the biology of aging, procreative freedom as we understand it today will no longer be feasible. And one can't realistically tell people in a post-aging world to go and have kids on Alpha Centauri or something like that. People essentially, once aging becomes technically optional, they won't want to grow old themselves. They will want to ensure that their pets are quasi-immortal too. There is going to need to be a debate about whether you think the carrying capacity of the Earth or the solar system is 15 billion or 150 billion. Nonetheless, there are physical limits. I wouldn't say it's an imminent worry. The serious debate will start when radical anti-aging technologies become widely accessible.
I think a lot of hot bimbos, they would really like some anti-aging technologies.
Oh yeah. Yeah, yeah. There will be a market there. There already is a giant market of, you know, scam products.
So what do you tell to the bimbo who wants immortality?
Well, I mean,
like, how do you sell the bimbo on being immortal?
I probably wouldn't use the term bimbo. or even bimboy. Though we're saying this with a chuckle, I mean, sadly, for evolutionary reasons, the visible signs of aging are profoundly distressing to many people. I mean, not just women, but
not just thoughts.
Balding cuts. Yeah, exactly. Hair loss, I think, is a huge, huge actual stressor in men. I haven't looked at data about, but I'm sure it is.
Oh yeah, men get mad at that all the time. But I have a friend who's just beautiful, and he's bald, and he's kind of like a larger guy, and he's just. He has this beautiful, charming essence, and he just like kills it with the ladies. And I'm just like, and it all just comes down to like his personality. And I don't know, like, I think personality matters. I mean, you know, we can, you know, go through all these metrics of beauty and all this other stuff. And, you know, I mean, in some ways, I'm a bit of a Humean in that, you know, beauty's in the eye of the beholder. And, in another sense, I'm just like, I think, how do we create the technologies that, like, how do we account for all of this stuff? You know, because then the words change and the language changes and then the metaphysics change. And then we have to be like, well, you know, is some of the part of the reason that we create this technology is to create a belief in the technology? Or are we just sort of like creating new metaphysics, you know, and like sort of renaming things? Like that's kind of what I'm wondering.
I'm not sure where to go with that one. The technologies of anti-aging. For evolutionary reasons, sadly, being beautiful or handsome is not entirely arbitrary. That some
a
people
construct,
are.
This technology is going to help people be beautiful forever.
That would be a better sell than I think a lot of the things that transhumanists have argued already.
Essentially, you know, one could have a debate over, should we aim for immortality, the defeat of aging, and plenty of bioconservatives will weigh in arguing otherwise. But you have a miracle anti-wrinkle cream that hits the stores, essentially it'd be wildly popular.
But wouldn't that just reinforce narcissism, which is in its own sense like a kind of like inner dialogue of enslavement and entrapment? And I think society is kind of like a problem with that, and that's why we don't live in a society, because everyone's a narcissist.
I would beg to differ here that too many people do not like themselves, or at least are extremely conflicted. Everyone ought to love themselves. I mean, one wouldn't give this advice to Donald Trump. But essentially Darwinian bodies are a cause of tremendous suffering. And essentially, in the long run, we ought to be aiming for a world in which everyone loves, not merely loves other sentient beings, but loves themselves. And I don't know if it's ever been attempts at rigorous quantification, but how many people would really say that
the narcissist hates themselves. They just, you know, like there's a psychological disposition, which is why that they can never truly seek otherness, is because they actually hate themselves.
That would be a
deficit of self-love.
I mean,
I think bliss comes from not thinking about yourself. I think I seek to never think about myself. I take the self out. Like I don't like to think about myself. Like that to me is like the essence of modern suffering.
I mean, there is sort of Andre Gromyko, when asked about his personality, said, "My personality does not interest me." But exceptional examples like that, yeah, most people are interested in themselves. That for evolutionary reasons, each of us finds himself or herself at the center of the universe, the hub of reality. So any kind of predisposition to being self-centered, if the term narcissistic is too ideologically freighted, a predisposition to be self-centered is extremely fitness enhancing. It's been incredibly adaptive. Whether post-humans will experience the egocentric illusion in the way you or I do is clearly speculative. But it's part of the human predicament. Finding oneself, apparently at the center of the universe, how the center of the universe follows you around, but at the same time, most people don't seem to appreciate this fact. Indeed, most people entertain the illusion that they are the center of the universe.
Yeah. Well, clearly we're not the center of the universe because the Anthropocene is ending. And that should be very obvious to most people. But yeah, no, I'm really interested in sort of like how all the stuff ties in with what will this look like? That's the thing, is what will this look like? Are you a fan of art, David Pierce?
I enjoy a beautiful art. I have beautiful experiences out in nature, even though I am ambivalent, and that I have at the same time an extremely dark conception of what Darwinian life in nature involves. And yet,
it is beautiful. I think it's beautiful. Like watching one animal eat another. Like, I'm just kind of like, wow,
that's a struggle personally. But I frankly, like a big source of like, peace and solitude is like being out in nature. And after kind of having, thought through the ethics of things, there definitely was like a reframing. But eventually, without seeing that aspect of it, I can still very much like zoom out and appreciate like the symmetries and the kind of like larger than human aspect to like being in Yosemite, for instance. But yeah, I'm not probably watching the gazelle get eaten by the lion anymore.
being eaten alive is unimaginably dreadful and obscene. And essentially we need to phase out predation, and that any predisposition to find anything beautiful or romantic or witter on about the cycle of life or something is to be discouraged. That, for evolutionary reasons, hunters, humans being hunters and gatherers, not everyone experiences a feeling of repugnance seeing the suffering of a
But what about non-human animals when they eat each other?
This is precisely what I am arguing, that a living world based on sentient beings harming each other is grotesque. And in the long run, we are going to phase it out. One sees in the biblical book of Isaiah.
So do we put wild boars on a vegan diet too, or...?
Essentially, non-vegan animals can be veganized. In the meantime, there are stop gaps one can use in the case of obligate carnivores. For example, a cat can be fed on catnip-laced cultured mincemeat or animal products. In the long run, I think we need to have a debate whether we want to preserve obligate carnivores and predators, or whether we should essentially retired them, or alternatively, and this is what I argue on grounds of sociological plausibility, that members of so-called charismatic megafauna that are predators should be veganized. It's fanciful to talk like this while we are still systematically harming non-humans in factory farms and slaughterhouses. But in the long run, we're going to want to veganize the biosphere.
So we veganize the tigers and the lions?
Yes.
That's very interesting. I think that's kind of funny. Just imagine a lion
facing a robotic gazelle with lab-grown meat strapped to it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's the thing, is you can grow meat in a lab, basically. That's kind of... Which does that make it vegan, though?
It is.
Yeah, I mean, one could be pedantic and say, well, this isn't veganism. Veganism and in vitro-tarian from in vitro cultured meat. But essentially, the diet doesn't have to involve cruelty and suffering. And the Transhumanist Declaration of 1998, 2009 expresses our commitment to the well-being of all sentients. And this will entail, by its very nature, getting rid of predation, starvation, and the horrors of nature red in tooth and claw.
Would you say, though, that, if this is kind of a step beyond the last man, one thing Francis Fukuyama talked about in his book, at the end of the history, is that the Nietzschean last man, or the kind of like bug pod Soylent drinker person who's just sort of like trying to like bliss out and not really feel anything, that he may become bored and start to like assert a will to power at a certain point, just basically out of sheer boredom. What do you think of that?
Essentially, the biology of boredom is likely to be phased out. This doesn't mean to say that we are going to find all of life indiscriminately interesting, but nonetheless, the raw feels of boredom as we understand it today, which is often a form of mass depression, but essentially boredom can become physiologically impossible too. I mean, this is the beauty of life based on information-sensitive gradients of bliss. One can retain whatever functional analogues one wants of traditional Darwinian feelings, but minus their nasty raw feels, in that some aspects of the world can seem even more fascinating than others. But even the dips can still be far more intriguing than the most fascinating aspects of Darwinian life.
That's really interesting. I'm wondering how we do that. I'm just trying to figure it out. I think it's all very, very fun. I really enjoy talking to you. This has been very, very interesting conversation. I don't know what it's kind of getting late here. I don't know. Is there anything you wanted to say, Duncan and David? Anything else you guys want to talk about or discuss?
I think we can, Duncan, some concluding thoughts.
I think basically, to answer your question of how we do this stuff, there is just a scope of, how much do you focus on the self versus like the world around you? And I think if listeners do want to like really think seriously about their own mental health, like David has written probably one of the best texts called The Good Drug Guide, which has been updated over many years, with a variety of, facts about all of these various antidepressives and techniques. I think that there's a lot that you can kind of do on your own level. And then, I think, while I've struggled with consistency with veganism, I think some kind of, larger ethical program will probably be in order. And not least, I think David will be, justified in hundreds of years when we look back at meat eaters as the same as child abusers, which, I struggle with when I'm eating a steak still. So yeah, I mean, I think that there's a spectrum of kind of, internal things that can kind of go in line with this, which I do think like all listeners should take their own mental health very seriously. And then, larger cultural, rhetorical, as well as like political and coordination aspects. But yeah, I don't know. I feel like this was a really great discussion.
Yeah, no, definitely. David?
Ooh, good heavens. One generalization that wraps up our discussion. That would be a challenge. No, it's been great chatting to you both. Just to reinforce what Duncan was saying, yes, I think one does have an obligation to try to take care of one's own mental health, because that way one can then go on to be more effective in helping others. If anyone has been interested in some of the themes we've explored, join us. I mean, I said my original Motherload website, state-of-the-art web design 1996, is headweb.com, HEDWEB.com, headweb.com. Or sad to say, like so many people, I've been sucked into social media. So feel free to join us on the Hedonistic Imperative Facebook group. But Duncan Barrett, thanks very much for a very stimulating discussion.
Yeah, thank you so much. I just want to say you don't need SSRIs, practiced Dzogchen, short moments of open intelligence. It will make your life a million times better. I say this as someone who used to put loaded pistols in my mouth all the time. So I haven't been depressed since. I will just say that I highly recommend it. So,
and I would also cut that by saying that one size does not fit all here. And like, frankly, what I've found is like SSRIs were also awful. But a combination of Wellbutrin and mirtazapine has been like hugely, hugely beneficial for me. And David has his own regime, which he could talk about. But I do agree. Do not settle for like, the first thing that comes your way. And if it's not working, do continue to play with it. Because, there are better states of consciousness available.
You have to try a lot of different things. But yeah, no. Well, thank you. Thank you both so much. That was very, very interesting and fun. I had a great time. So thanks a lot, and have a good day. For me, it's like almost 5 a.m. So
yeah, go get some sleep. Have fun DJing tomorrow.
All right. Okay. I'll see you guys.
Take care.
Soon. Okay.
Bye. Bye-bye, Barrett. Bye.